As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your alternative talk radio contact, The Planet, KGRARadio.com.
Infinite complacence. People went to and fro, fierce about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
So on this edition of Into the Fray, I have on with me James P. Aiken, and he is the author of Elkins Creek. Came out very recently in October of 2020. He is a former sheriff's deputy, and he is in the area of Georgia. Pat, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. I'm pleased to be here with you.
Now, something that I mentioned to you, and you already were aware of this before we started to record, but this all came about me talking to you because I was talking to my guest from episode 194, and that was titled The Peace Officer and the Cryptids of Flint River. It's definitely one of my more popular episodes for obvious reasons. It's got a few different elements that really interest people, including a former law enforcement officer, which is also what you are, and he brought you up and he said, have you heard of this story with James P. Aiken? And I said, no, I'm actually not familiar with that. He goes, well, he wrote a book. And so I went on the hunt for you, which I don't normally do, if I'm being honest. I have actually a backlog of people that I need to speak to. So when I went on the hunt for you, I was hoping to talk to you, of course. And I tried several different avenues, as you know, and I just was kind of coming up flush with things. And then within, I'd say, 2 weeks of me deciding to go on the hunt for you, Kyle Filson of Expanded Perspective sends me an email out of the blue. And of course, Cam and Kyle and I, we talk about all sorts of things. We text, we email. But this was the first time he had emailed me specifically about, hey, we just had a guest on a couple months back. He was fantastic. I think he's a great fit for your show. Here's his contact info and here's what he's about. And lo and behold, it was you. It was you he emailed me about. And I just thought it was so very strange. And I told him how odd that was. And of course, how much I appreciated that. But anyhow, long story short, you're here and I'm extremely excited to have you. So yeah, but huge high five to Kyle. I don't know the intuition or psychic powers that he holds, but here we are. So Pat, you're in Georgia. You're in a very rural part of Georgia, right? I mean, how long have you lived there? Give me whatever background that you want to give me as far as you and your work. And of course, you know, why we might be sitting here talking today.
Well, I'm a native Georgian, born and raised here. The area we're talking about is not so rural now, because we're talking about a time that's roughly 25 some odd years ago, say around the time of 1993, 1994. Now, at the time, rural Pike County, Georgia was, in fact, still rural to some large degree. I mean, you could literally, in some places in the county, cross the entire county with never really touching concrete from a paved road. It was very, well, agrarian, I think, is the right word to use. I mean, there were still lots of farms and stuff there, and we've had an influx since the late 90s that's caused some urbanization in the area. But as sheriff's deputy, and I was a young man at that time, I was in my 20s, we were sort of, and this will probably be hard to believe, I believe you're out west somewhere in a very urban sort of setting, but we literally, I mean, at nighttime would have one deputy on duty in the entire county, barring the dispatcher or jailer at the sheriff's office. And you were, in essence, the night deputy or the night sheriff. I mean, you were the person that handled basically everything that happened in the county at night. Barring that, you know, you'd have to wake someone up out of bed if you needed backup. And to give you a for instance, at that time, my first backup was the city of Zebulon, but sometimes they wouldn't have an officer on duty. So then that fell to Thomaston, which was a 30-minute drive away. And if it was after 11 o'clock, it was GSP Manchester, which was Georgia State Patrol Post in Manchester. So it's 45 minutes. So just to set the stage for people to understand, you're out there by yourself. It's very wooded. It's very rural. And you were responsible for answering basically anything, any kind of call that may come your way during whatever the shift was. It was 12 hours, I believe, at the time. And it come to pass over time that they had this gentleman that he kept calling in with prowler calls. And, you know, you go out there and check around his home and never find anything. You know, he would say something's tapping on the outside of the house, or something's, you know, really happening, you know, here. I'm not crazy. And you would respond. You'd get there as fast as you could, which sometimes, depending upon where you were in the county, might be a 30-minute drive across the county to get out to this gentleman's residence. And the residence was way out. It was kind of on the edge of the Bottoms, which are near Elkins Creek. And you have to understand that Elkins Creek traverses Pike County. It's roughly 20, 23 miles or so where it goes into Upson County and empties into the Flint River. So we're talking about an area in the far area in the county. And, you know, you get out there and you check. And this was, and this is perhaps, I need to set this to make people understand. In 1993, and I forgot the name of the hurricane, a hurricane came ashore from the Gulf of Mexico, and it sat over Georgia seemingly for 2 weeks and flooded the entire state. Macon got cut off because of the river down in Albany that literally had coffins float up out of graveyards and float down the street. In some areas, there was so much water flow. And this is prior to these events. And my first guess is that if this is a biological entity in the traditional sense that people talk about it being a remnant sort of hominid or some surviving creature, it was driven out of wherever it lived, although my opinion changed over time. But anyway, all of this started happening. We would get the telephone calls and people would respond. And the first thing that I noticed was that I would arrive at the scene and there would be an awful smell. in the air. And I mean, it's not describable. I tried to describe the smell of the book, but it, you know, just awful, like a combination of urine, of feces, of rotting garbage. It's just a terrible odor. You know, and I would check. I would go, I'd take flashlight, I'd make contact with the complainant, and then I would leave, and I would go check and look around, and I would try to be as thorough as I possibly could, but never found anything on those trips. And it just really, just slowly over the next few months, it progressed, you know, and I was left at the time believing that this was not, in fact, something paranormal, but was in fact someone harassing this man and his wife. And you have to understand that, and I think anybody who's experienced this, that you have a reality shift. Sometimes it's on the way home from an event, but later on I discovered, you know, that, well, you know, this shouldn't be here. And I'm leaping forward. But let me just say, at the time, I'm kind of pedantic about my job. I'm out there, I'm looking for human assailants. I'm looking for kids. I'm looking for somebody who's out harassing this guy. And I couldn't find evidence of that. So slowly over time, though, as things progressed, things started happening. Like he had a little shed out there, and he had some whole kernel corn in it and some dog food. The dogs were missing, by the way, at the time. He had one little dog in the house. It was a little, looked like a Chihuahua mix named Peanut, but there were no big dogs, although he stated there had been big dogs, but they had gone missing. But anyway, like I said, all the food had been stolen. We're talking about 50-pound sacks of food. They're suddenly missing. I see a dent. He complains one time that there's a dent in the wall, the outside exterior wall of the house. And there surely is, you know, he says something has whispered to them, you know, in their bedroom at night, you know, through the window or whatever. And he described it as a very low sort of growly sort of voice. And it had mocked him calling the little dog Peanut. Well, all of these events keep snowballing. And I'm giving you just sort of a synopsis of this because a lot happened. And towards the end of it, just due purely to economic reasons, because, you know, for all my faults, I do like to have a meal occasionally and some health insurance. So I had left the jurisdiction, and this would have been right around the November of that year before, and I moved to another jurisdiction, but I kept my foot in the water. I had volunteered at a smaller city jurisdiction in the county. So I kept track of this. And then one day I just asked him, I said, look, I want to come out and give a walk down the creek and see what's back there. Because in my mind, we're dealing with a criminal element. And I figure, you know, maybe somebody is wanting to move drugs, contraband liquor, something, and they want this guy out of the way. So I went down the creek that morning, and I got down there, and there was a copse of trees, and I was walking along the edge, and I looked, and I noticed there was a disturbance in the water because the water had finally ceased. This would have been in like April of 94, and I saw that something had walked through, or down rather, the creek. And I get up among the copse of trees, and there's a mud bank that's sitting up. And I'm pretty positive it probably had been displaced or moved or piled up there from the excess water from the hurricane. But there, sitting in the mud bank, was a huge footprint. And I climbed down from the bank, went out into the creek, and looked at it. And I don't know. The only thing I can really, I've tried to describe that as well, but I just had this feeling that I was immediately in danger. And in fact, I stayed there. I looked around. I held myself where I was until I finally just said, you know, you really need to get out of here and back up. I did. And in fact, I even, I didn't unholster my weapon, but they had a thumb brake on it. And I broke the thumb brake so I could pull my pistol if I needed to. And I slowly went out of the area after I saw it. And I had a big argument with myself because part of me said, you know, somebody's goofing, perhaps not on the old man. Maybe they're messing with you. Because I'm still making these analytical, logical leaps in my mind, you know, that this, you know, this is somehow human related. Somebody, a Homo sapien is behind this. I got up there to my vehicle and I said, no, you know, you really need to record this. And at the time I had a small kit that I kept with me. For things like a fingerprints and whatever. So I fetched it, went back, and I cast the footprint cast that became known as the Elkins Creek cast. And, you know, the amazing thing, and I've pointed this out in the book, was that, you know, the second trip down, I wasn't frightened at all. I got down there. I didn't have the feeling of foreboding. It was completely absent. Although I have noted that there was a strange smell of ozone in the air, see, and it was a sort of a clear, you know, it was early in the morning. It was like 7:30-ish and it was still kind of gray. The light was bluish gray, sort of dawn sort of light. And I had that smell. And, you know, of course, this is pre-cell phone. A lot of people don't remember that time, but it was pre-cell phone. And, you know, I couldn't flip out an app and check the weather, but it was a clear day. And if I remember correctly, I remember any kind of storming. So I've yet to explain the ozonation of the atmosphere around. I finished the cast and there were three or four more footprints leading up to the mud bank. And I had to guesstimate sort of the length, but I mean, the distance was like around 64 to 72 inches just off the top of my head and between each track. And I said, well, you know, I kept looking. I remember I kept looking to try to see if someone was placing like a wooden foot, you know, because there's no way in the silt at the bottom of the creek that they could disguise their own footprints.
Right.
But I didn't see that. And I kept, you know, like I said, I was very analytical. I was a police officer and I was looking at this stuff. Then I noticed from where the footprint was on the mud bank that the grass on the far bank had been displaced. And then it dawned on me that whatever had taken a step onto this little mud bank, because it was elevated to probably about a foot, maybe a foot and a half above the water level in the creek, they had stepped up and over about, you know, it was like 4 feet up to the other bank and 6 to 8 feet over. And I could see a place scuffed on one of the far trees where they had gripped the actual trunk of the tree to pull themselves up and had displaced. And I said, well, whatever did this in one step. And I don't know. It was just absolutely, I knew then, I said, there's no way. What is this? How did somebody do this? You know, what kind of person could pull this off? Well, long story short, when the cast was finished and it hardened and I was able to separate it, you know, I got up and basically I didn't even go. I just went and got my truck and left. I didn't want to tell the guy what I'd found because I didn't think it would benefit him. And, you know, maybe I was wrong in that assumption, but I felt like if he's already terrorized, this certainly is not going to help his situation at all. And I really didn't have at the time the authority to go back there. So I took it. I went home. Essentially, I put it in a closet. I did make an immediate supervisor aware of it, a former supervisor aware of it. And he said he would check with the powers that be. And they said, you know, just let it go. You know, no part of this.
They said, let it go.
Yeah. It's like, you know, there's nothing, you know, we can't, but this, you know, you have to understand that, I wouldn't find fault with him, because at the time, it's a very tiny, small, you know, sheriff's department. No one had died or been killed. And, you know, you start presenting a cast like this out, you're going to be a laughing stock.
Right.
And you can't afford that, law enforcement. You know, you can't do that sort of thing. And he said, look, he said, you know, in the end game, he said, I'll look into it. He said, but this was the amazing thing, is he said, you know, my uncle has found those before. And I said, what?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, down at the, he says, far off down in the bottoms, you know, down along the Flint down there, they've had the occasion to stumble across those. And I was like, well, you know, whatever. I said, I'm going to a new place. I'm at a new place. I'm going to put this in the closet. I'm going to let it go. Now, what I didn't realize was that it wasn't going to necessarily let me go. I said, you know, I'll put this up. And, you know, I'll be honest with you. I feel like it now, in hindsight, that perhaps I had some post-traumatic stress syndrome, because the first year or two, I would awaken in a cold sweat and I would be dreaming and I would be in that spot. Whatever happened to me, whatever touched me during the time when I initially found that footprint, it touched me in such a way that I don't know if there was a battle going on in my subconscious or what was taking place, but I'd awaken in a cold sweat. But eventually this subsided some, and I just went on. Well, the incident, to leap forward 3 years, the thing's been in the closet. I've left it alone. I've essentially forgotten about it. I have put it away. A friend, I was at a local, you know, gun shop and overheard a conversation. I knew this guy. I mean, we were acquaintances, and he was talking about he was going to go out Washington State, Oregon, someplace out there. I think he said Blue Mountains. I'm, you know, that's been 25 years ago, but he was going to make a trip to go investigate. You know, he said, I always wanted to go investigate Bigfoot. Well, I didn't believe in Bigfoot. And even at the time of this, I was still very skeptical. I said, you know, that's a bunch of stuff. I didn't go in for all that. And I told him, I said, well, you know, you don't have to go out there. I said, I've got a cast that I made a couple, 3 years ago. I said, yeah, he wanted to see it, obviously. So I brought it. And then he talked me into sending it out to, at the time, it was Dr. Grover Krantz. And Dr. Krantz looked at it, and it was sent back, but he wouldn't say anything in particular. So he prevailed upon me. He said, well, let's send it to this guy at Idaho State University, Dr. Jeff Meldrum. And mm-hmm. I said, okay. You know, no sweat off my brow. So we sent the thing out there. I think a few months passed, and then they come back, and they said, well, you know, this is authentic to what we're finding out here in the Pacific Northwest. I don't know if he was still a police officer at the time, but a forensic fingerprint examiner, Jimmy Chilcutt, had examined the cast and found microdermal ridges that were like those found in great primates. And I got the, you know, we get the report back, and I tell you the truth is, you know, I said that your reality shifts on the way home sometimes. Well, that day it did, because I felt like, well, these guys are seeing this stuff. You know, people are bringing these casts for evaluation. Something else was out there. This wasn't a goof. This wasn't somebody trying to hoax me. Something else was out there. And I never saw it. And I'll admit that. I mean, I'll tell people point blank, no, I checked. I smelled the awful smell. You know, I looked around. But that day, I felt something out there on that creek. And that's really where my journey into this began. Because, you know, like I said, prior to this, I didn't believe it. I didn't believe in it. And, you know, what do you say to that, to somebody who's never had this sort of encounter? And, you know, suddenly their world shifts, and something that they thought was basically folkloric has presented itself. And that began, basically, I don't want to necessarily call it a quest, but I'll certainly call it a real interest in investigating and examining this phenomena. And of course, over the years, this has transformed itself in my personal life, and I've started looking at things in a much broader perspective than I once did. And it's, you know, we all evolve as people throughout our lives. What we may accept at the age of 19 may be completely unacceptable at the age of 45. And in this same way, you know, this has been an organic process for me as a person who experienced what I feel personally now was a paranormal event rather than me just encountering some sort of relic, caveman or hominid sort of creature that's managed to survive in one of the most populous countries in the world, you know. My thinking has evolved. And in this happened a few years later myself. And while this is not necessarily related to the actual incident at Elkins Creek, we formed an investigation group and we aptly named it the Georgia Swamp Ape Research Center. But we went out and initially we were one of these groups of people that thought, well, if it's biological, if it has mass, if it's a caveman or if some kind of ape, we can catch it. So, you know, we started to think we're going to have to collect a specimen. So we went through all of the routine, I think, that most people involved in this go through, which is, you know, we started hunting it essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not much luck, frankly. You know, we pulled all sorts of stuff. We had what I felt like were a few brief encounters of noises or things like that, but never anything like that. And only in, you know, subsequently, after really the group basically parted ways, we fell apart. I would go out foolishly, but I might add now, by myself. I'd pack a day pack and I'd arm myself. And I did in subsequent trips, I found one trap path in the swamp that was not castable, although it fit the parameters of the Elkins cast. But the one that changed me was the second track path, which I followed. It had been rainy. The bottoms were wet and it left a good impression. And I started following the track, but whatever it was sinking up probably about 4 or 5 inches into the forest floor. And it was leaf littered. I followed it, you know, probably at least 300 yards, which doesn't seem like a long way, but if you're in the middle of brush and in the bottom of a swamp, it's a long way. But it finally exited the bottom land and was heading up to like an escarpment. It was higher ground. And I followed it. It was making really good tracks. And then it went into what, and when I say a circle of trees, I want people to understand I'm not saying something that's like a standing stones or some sort of temple or something that was man-made. I mean, it just naturally was like a little amphitheater of trees around it. Went there, followed it, got into the center of that, and it just ceased. Well, I started doing concentric circles. I mean, I know how to track. I've been in this for a long time. I looked and looked and looked and looked. And it was just forest floor. There was no granite exposed. There was no way something could have exited out of that area without leaving some sort of trace of their passing or its passing. And you know what? That day, I decided that we're dealing with something beyond Gigantopithecus black eye. We're dealing with something else. And I haven't gone back by myself ever since that time and refuse, won't go into the woods on this sort of adventure, sort of, you know, you're going to go there specifically for that without a partner or somebody. And in fact, I'll be honest with you, the last few years I've been laid up, I got injured, and I haven't really been out there, so I'm not an active researcher at the moment. I'm working on getting my health back to where I can go out and be active, but it gave me time to basically explore all of the information I had seen from Elkins Creek Ford, and to correlate it and tabulate, to put things together. And that's when you see Elkins Creek, because Elkins Creek is a non-traditional book. And I decided I'm going to write the book the way I want to write the book. I said, I'm a proficient technical writer, but I said, I don't feel like I have to just present this one story, because the story in and of itself doesn't give a big enough umbrella picture of what I'm talking about when I present the information in Elkins Creek. So I sat down, I brought everything together as best I could, all the people I'd talked to over the years, basically collected, collated, got this stuff together, and I gave my viewpoint basically to the world about this phenomenon. And I want people to consider this, because I'm not here preaching necessarily that any person has to agree with me. And this is what I want people to understand. I'm not one of these types that say, if you don't agree with me, you need to shut up. I'm four square against any kind of censorship, and I'm a free thinker, and I'm for freedom of thought for any person, whether your view of Bigfoot's diametrically opposed to mine or not. You have your right to have your opinion. Okay. And I felt like this needed to be said, and it was my opinion, so I threw it out there. And I just tell you, to encapsulate in a nutshell, I felt like after reviewing many kinds of different paranormal events, looking at the history of this, I feel like people have proclivities. Everybody has something. I don't know. You said you had a paranormal event in your life, and I don't know what that is. But everything in your life since then is going to revolve around the incident that you encountered. I mean, it's obvious. I mean, you're doing a show. You're doing a show about the subject matter. So it's affected your life in that way. And in my way, it affected my life in that I produced Elkins Creek. And any other person out there listening knows that if they've truly had an encounter, it's altered their perceptions. Well, what I dawned on me finally, eventually, was this. Yes, okay, it's a given. I know for a fact that the creature, the entity, whatever you want to call Sasquatch or Bigfoot, does have mass. It left footprints. That means that it does exist, but does it exist in the sense that we, through empiric science, would suggest that it is a continually existing creature, like a tribe of these things that exist and move around and migrate around, which is the prevailing theory in most Bigfoot research for many years now? What if it were something else? You see, I started thinking about the notion of a forest of paranormal, because we have many paranormal events in the world. We have Bigfoot, Mothman, all sorts of stuff. What's another example of something? UFOs, aliens, whatever. Okay. I can go stand and stare at the Bigfoot tree all day long, and I can perceive that the tree next to it is the alien tree, but that's not my tree. Or I can look at the Mothman tree and it's not my tree. But what we have to do as investigators is we've got to back off of this, and we've got to see that underlying all of these trees is a root system. And perhaps we're looking at symptoms of a much larger phenomena, which is to say that paranormal activity is a forest rather than just an individual phenomenon. And from that, I mean, that's where I'm at today. I mean, I'm currently working on some other stuff, you know. One's non-paranormal related, and one is going to be kind of not necessarily a follow-up to Elkins Creek per se, but something to assist someone to go out there and explore this on their own. And I don't know, I know I've got kind of long-winded, forgive me, but I just wanted to let you have an idea of this is where I'm at. And this is a journey, just like you're on a journey. And any person out there who is into this understands that this is a journey. And just be aware that whatever's out there is aware that you're on this journey. And I would say this, to be careful out there. Because if you notice them, they pay you the courtesy of noticing you back. And I say the anthropomorphic they, because I don't, who knows what we're dealing with in this. And I know that sounds ominous, and it's not supposed to be. I don't mean it to be. But on the other hand, you know, and I made an addendum to Elkins Creek, which is, you know, when I really got back into this and I really started researching this again and I decided to produce a product, all sorts of crazy stuff started happening in my life, you know, and I'm not out in the woods chasing Bigfoot. It's just here at the house. So, like I said, the law of attraction is real in lots of different ways. So.
No, I didn't want to interrupt you. You were on a roll and I was enjoying listening to you. But I, of course, have some questions. But I don't, if you want to finish your thought there before I jump in here.
No, go ahead, please. Ask questions.
Yeah, so Pat, you mentioned the incident where you walk into the stand of trees and the footsteps are just poof, gone. And you'd been following these very distinct impressions for, like you said, 300 yards at least, which is a good clip, by the way. If you're in the forest and you're trying to track something, it's very difficult. When you realize that things are gone and you can't figure out a way that something flesh and blood, even big and powerful and strong, could have done that, just in a normal sense, did you kind of go, well, damn, that's kind of a bummer, because how are we going to figure out what this is? Or do we even have a shot at this?
You know, I'm just plainly honest with you. When I finished doing my sweep of the area to see if there had been an exit, because like I said, I wasn't prepared, unfortunately, and that's something I would advise anyone. If you're going to go out prepared to encounter these things. I had just done this. It was happenstance. I decided to run down and do this. You know, I had a sidearm, you know, or whatever. I was just going to make a run and take a look. See, so I didn't have anything to cast with or any of that. So anyway, yes, I was terrified, frankly. I didn't feel any foreboding. I mean, I'm not saying that I felt like I was in immediate danger, but the realization of whatever this was, I mean, barring the fact that someone lowered a rope or something from a helicopter, just basically vanished. And you know, that's why, you know, my stance changed. I was really, at one point, I was very much pro-kill. I said, you know, well, if this thing exists, we should collect a specimen. That incident changed all that for me. And I decided then, you know what, you really probably should, to some large degree, never go into woods again like this alone. And two, I doubt seriously if you can collect a specimen. I don't know if we're going to be able to prove that this exists in a truly empirically scientific manner. I really don't, because if you have something that has this sort of ability, then how are you going to collect that? What, you know, and also I point this out to people, what if it decides to collect you?
Well, and that's another point that I kind of jotted down to ask you later, but it's a good segue. Do you think that they may be responsible for some of these stories that we're hearing, like missing 411 types that are actually really very strange?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, Dave Pilates, I think he was a police officer, and I think Dave Pilates, from everything that I've read of his work, I think he's doing the real investigatorial groundwork and footwork on the cases he investigates. And, you know, he's ambiguous about conclusions because he can't reach conclusions, but some of the stories And I'm not as familiar with all of his stories, but in one, it was like out in Colorado, somewhere out there. The kid goes missing from like a lodge on one side of a mountain. They find the kid 12 hours later in a boulder field on the other side of the mountain. The child is, there's no way the child could have traversed a mountain in 12 hours. There's no way because the kid was younger than five. I mean, I think it was like three or four, somewhere in that range. There's no way. And, you know, all of these people going missing. And it's basically, again, you know, I started looking and seeing that there were always commonalities. And he points this out, I think, in his book. It's like you've got to have like granite. You got to have mountains. You've got to have water. You've got to have food items, you know, a place for foraging. And I don't know, you know, it just made me leap back to what the Native Americans had said about what Sasquatch or the Bigfoot. It's like, you know, well, he's a spirit man. That's what the Seminoles say. They say he's out there. He's a spirit man. So he can turn invisible. They'll tell you today, if you go to the Everglades, I mean, it's a very real part of their life. Out west, it's the same thing. Out around, you know, any Indian nation out there who has this, it's the same sort of description. And that got pointed out to me in my mind. I said, you know, that's very interesting because everything I've encountered really aligns much more nicely with what the Native Americans have said about this creature than what I'm reading from the popular science point of view. And, you know, you consider they were worried about this thing taking them away. And, you know, they had to live with this. We're talking about in the pre-Columbian days, certainly. You know, they were on guard. If you see one of these things, it's not good. It's a bad omen. You should avoid interacting with these things. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, it changed. That changed my view of this because then I started seeing that there was a deeper, I feel like, personally, a spiritual aspect to what these creatures may be or represent. And so, yeah, I think to go back to your question, can we collect one? Maybe. But, you know, if, you know, I've told anybody, this is not a contest for me. If you collect a flesh and blood creature tomorrow, I'll shut my mouth. You've solved the mystery. God bless you. But until then, we've got to keep our minds open. And we've got to stop just looking, you know, at these things in one way, because not all of the evidence that gets through the filter fits the classic definition of what these things are. And, you know, I'm not saying there's not potentially tribes of these things, but every day, you know, we all have that ubiquitous device on our belts with everybody has a cell phone with an excellent camera. We have satellites that take pictures of pennies on the ground from space. We're inundated in our national forest with people with cell phones in GoPros and other kinds of camera equipment. And yet we never seem to be able to get what I would feel is a clear, excellent, definitive proof sort of video of this creature. And I've done all the stuff. I've done the camera traps and all that. You know, got lots of deer, lots of other things. They're easy. Even caught a couple of people, you know, moving around through the woods. So we can catch each other, but we can't catch this. And it's a caveman? Come on.
Something you brought up earlier, and I just want to make sure that I have it straight so that, you know, my point is not just a moot one. But when you first went down into the creek and you had that foreboding feeling and you saw the tracks, you, at that point, there was no ozone smell. It wasn't until you went to get the casting material and came back down that you
That's right.
smelled it? Okay. So
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, so where I'm kind of going with this, especially if I'm bouncing off of kind of where your mind is with Bigfoot right now, because I can't even think of exactly where I'm pulling this from. It's probably my own show, but I don't always have the best memory. But I seem to remember, not just on one occasion, where somebody said that, you know, they saw something. I'm assuming it was probably a Sasquatch, a Bigfoot, and then it was gone, and there was, in fact, the smell of ozone, right? And you didn't say that earlier when you were going to the calls to the house that that was the smell. It seems like that was a completely different smell. So, you know, what's your thoughts on the ozone smell? Is that some kind of a remnant of them coming in and out, or whatever it was, left the area? So that was what was left behind, because you didn't have the feeling of foreboding when you went back down into the creek.
Well, you know, I can't say. I'm just going to be honest with you. I included that anecdotally because it existed and I observed it. You know, I don't know, in my mind, and this is all purely conjecture, could something electrical have happened? Or, you know, because the only time I've ever smelled the ozone in the air is like prior to an electrical storm. I don't know. And I throw it out there just because it was an anecdote that at the time. Now, I don't, you know, I'm just, you know, I've got to be honest. It's a guess as much for me. I don't buy into this expertise thing. If you've got a Sasquatch in your garage and you're living with him and you're observing him, you're an expert. But otherwise, we're all in the same boat together. We argue over which end of the lifeboat is right, but the truth is we're all in the same lifeboat. And, you know, I don't know. I do know that at the time of the casting, you know, well, prior to the casting, when I first observed it, yes, I felt like that I was in fight or flight. Now, none of this is registering at the moment mentally. It's not like I'm standing there saying, oh, I'm in fight or flight. I'm like, wow, what's up with this? You know, first I'm looking at that, and really I'm going through this sort of list in my mind, like, well, you know, somebody's hoax and so on. But then I just realized, I said, well, you know, this is pretty odd. And it's just, this feeling grew in me that, you know, you really need to get out of here. You need to leave the area. And in the book, I described it as primordial, because it really was. It was like I had encountered, you know, a short-faced cave bear or something. I was, you know, I was out hunting and with a spear, and I knew that I was imminently in danger. So I backed up and backed out. And I had a 40 caliber Glock, or no, actually it was a Centurion, a Beretta at the time. And I was, you know, I'm a much smaller person now, but I was a pretty big guy in my 20s, and I could handle myself. And I just said, you know, you need to beat feet. And I kind of backed my way out of there and went back. Like I said, you go through all of this whole inner sort of dialogue that takes place, which is, you know, you just ran out of there. You're a punk. What are you doing? You need to go back, whatever. And I went through this. And then, like I said, I fetched that and I said, you've got to record this. You've got to do this. So I was young, and I'd gone through some forensic stuff at Academy and different things. I said, you've got to do this. I went back and I steeled myself. I worked up some bravery and I went back up there. But then it was like it was gone. It was like something had been projected onto me. Now, I'm not saying that I feel like this really was the case, that something telepathically did this to me, okay? I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that whatever inside of me felt much more at ease on my return trip for the casting. Now, as far as the ozone, I just noted, I really noted that later. At the time, I smelled it. And I think at the time, I thought it was odd, especially considering I remember that it was a clear day. What was it? I don't know. Although we do know this, we know this from science, that you know, we have specific things that happen in the atmosphere with lightning storms and you know, the negative particle, the negative electrons and the positive, you know, protons or whatever, this sort of interaction is taking place between the sky and the ground. But I don't remember a thunderstorm after that or anything like it. So perhaps, you know, like I said, it's anecdotal, but that's for anyone else to, you know, but you're not the first person, you know. It's interesting you say that because the guys on Expanded Perspectives told me about a guy who had written a book about smells that were associated with
the paranormal,
unexplained,
yeah,
phenomena.
Yeah, Joshua Kutchin. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I had never heard of him until Expanded Perspectives. You know, I don't know, around the house area, around that time, the smell, and I never detected this, see, at the scene up there, if I remember, but it was all around the house, and it would, my logical assumption at the time was, oh, with somebody over there, you know, it's nighttime, smells carry when it's cooler, sound gets thrown some because of the atmosphere. Somebody probably has a pig pen or something over a distance away up there, you know, just drifting in over the area, but never encountered it. It was, like I said, it was awful. It was a terrible smell. It'd make you gag. And I, unfortunately, sort of have a weak stomach. So, you know, I'd have to kind of soldier my way through that. I don't know. You know, there's no answers, and I'm not trying to. Everything I'm telling you is me conjecturing. I'm not an expert.
No, and I mean, Pat, first of all, huge high five on the "there are no Bigfoot experts" comment, because I say it all the time, because how in the actual hell could there be, right?
Right.
But as far as your Elkins Creek cast goes, what were the measurements of those footprints?
It was roughly 18 inches long and 8 wide. You know, I think it was like 5 or 6 at the heel. And it sunk in. And, of course, this was red sort of clay. If you've ever been to Georgia, we have red clay here. And it was at least an inch into that, which had been packed. It was a huge footprint. You know, like I said, I didn't know really at the time what to make of it. And especially on the heels of it, after what Dr. Meldrum said and Jimmy Chilcutt, I still, to some degree, don't know what to make of it. I mean, the creature would have to be huge. I mean, literally 8 feet tall, 9 feet tall. And, you know, the subsequent tracks that I saw, they were similarly sized, but certainly not as large as the Elkins track. They were shorter by a couple of 3 inches in one case, but they were still too big to be from a human being, because, you know, even in Georgia, even though we're kind of temperate down here, but you don't want to go walking barefooted through the muddy swamp bottom.
No.
You know, in the wintertime. So, I don't know. I feel a lot of ways I could be defined more as a person who has become an educated witness, or a person who is truly just out there investigating like everybody else who's interested in this. And I'm just trying to share, you know, my information with people for the next generation. You know, because I'm getting kind of long in the tooth, and I figured that some of the stuff that I believe, or some of the stuff that I've encountered, I wanted to pass it on. And so maybe somebody in a younger generation who's out there is young, you know, that out there actively doing stuff can use this information, and maybe they can make some sense out of it that I might never know, because I don't know if I'll ever live to see the solution to this.
Pat, did the homeowner ever find out about what you found, or, I mean, anything about what was going on in that situation?
It ceased. See, and this is the interesting thing, is, and this is also one of the things that made me put it up and just forget about it, was because afterwards I checked with him, and he said, you know, no, it's been weeks now since anything's happened. And I said, well, okay, you know.
And so after you cast, after you were down there in the creek and made the cast, it ceased for him.
It ceased, which led me to believe, frankly, that perhaps this was not a goof on him, but maybe on me. You see, that's why I'm saying to you, it's like, you know, and it was pointed out to me by a very learned investigator years later. He said, you know, what's more likely, you encountered something strange down there or some kind of rogue anthropologist who has the ability to produce this cast is down there a mile back in the woods, you know, in the swamp back there, producing this cast to goof on you. So I don't know, you know, I don't really honestly to some degree understand or know what I encountered. Although it's interesting, you know, you said earlier that Kyle had mentioned me to you. But previous to this, you were already researching and looking for my low profile self, right? So I don't know. I've come to believe in what I like to call the matrix of coincidence. And Dr. Carl Jung discussed it. I mean, it's different that a person suddenly has a realization or something happens that opens their mind to some sort of higher understanding of life or of the world or of the universe, you know. I don't know. But it's very interesting when you, because you and I haven't spoken like this. You know, we played email tag a little bit, but I had no idea till you emailed me that you had even been looking for me. And then I certainly, you know, after you described the events bringing you to having our discussion today, that was the first thing when you said that really startled me, was the fact that you were looking for me. And then out of the blue, Kyle recommends me to you.
Yeah, and that's what I was really trying to impart to really both of you, because I've been doing my show nearly 6 years, and I've known Cam and Kyle the entire time. In fact, I've known them even before I started my show. But in 6 years, he's never just come out and said, hey, here's someone that I think you'd be great to interview him. He'd be great on your show. And I was blown away. I'm looking at your name and I'm like, I've been looking for James. How did you know this? What is going on here? No, it was a big deal.
It's just, to me, it's just another proof of this thing. I don't know what to call it. You know, I mean, they used to call it the new sphere, or that the earth is surrounded by electricity, that it's made up of thought. Because, you know, people, you know, you talk about in the law, I don't know if it's the first or the second law of thermodynamics, which is that energy exists. It's neither created nor is it destroyed. It may change forms, but energy continues to exist. Well, all of the energy that you, in your brain now, you're thinking, just like I am, and we're producing energy from our thought process, and our thoughts produce energy. And all of this energy goes somewhere. Now, I'm I'm a religious person, and I believe in prayer. I believe in higher powers. I believe in those sorts of things. And I know from my own life that if you pray, there are tangible answers to prayer. Okay? If you're an atheist, I respect your belief that there is no God, okay? That's because that's what it's about, you know. Our walks are all individual, you know, in our lives. So I don't know what you believe, but I'm sure you have some view on the universe because you're a person, and we all form constructs about what the universe is. I have one view, you have another view. Each view is valid, but here's the point. The point is that the universe itself is composed of the same energy that we ourselves are composed of. And you try to get people to understand this, that what you know, the stuff that's being sent out is not wasted. It goes somewhere. You can't destroy the energy. We've proven this with empirical science. So, you know, is it a leap? Perhaps, you know. And I'm going to conjecture now, and I want this to go on the record as conjecture, but did a door open and this thing stepped through and a door shut and caused some sort of electronic or electrical distortion at the creek that day? I don't have the answer, but I can't preclude the possibility that something happened. Because years later, as I told you, you know, in my story about the circle of trees, there was no explanation for that either. And that's why, you know, I think we're having this discussion today is because people have got to change their perspective. I think that, well, let me say this. I've been undertaking sort of a study, and I've been looking at what I like to call para-waves. In the UFO world, they would call a sage or whatever, call it a flap. But what I started doing was looking at aligned events, events that were happening at the same time as, say, the UFO flap in 1973. And that's where I started. What happened in the Bigfoot world in 1973? What happened with winged humanoids in 1973? What happened? That's where I started initially, and I was going to do something completely on this, but basically the COVID-19 got me, not personally, but the travel and all of that. And I said, you know, well, I'm just going to do right now research. And what I've discovered is that periodically, say from 1966 to 73 or 75, rather, you see a marked increase in aligned events, both UFO, Bigfoot, Mothman, all of this stuff, and it swells and it builds and it builds. It reaches a point and then it drops away. And then it's quiet. Same sort of things happening in this area, say 93 to 95, around the Pine Mountain Range in Georgia. And there are other examples in other countries. I think they had something similar in France and something in Brazil. And it's like almost a window opens up and all of this stuff gets deposited here, and then the window shuts and it leaves. Now, it might leave physical evidence that it has been here, but all of our best search efforts, everything that we do to try to find the Bigfoot creature, the Mothman creature, whatever, there's no fruition because it's not there. It's literally not there. Although I feel like it leaves a psychic impression on the people who've been exposed to the phenomena. Say, you know, I'm sure, you know, the field is an example. I said, you know, you have Smallville, USA, the UFO, it lands out there. Farmer Jones records the fact that a UFO is out there. He tells the sheriff, they go out, they find places where the UFO landed in the ground, indentations. You know, it's big news there for a week or two. Years later, that field, which was once just, you know, a cornfield, now has become the UFO field. This is where the UFO landed. And it lasts and it remains. And it's almost, I feel like in a way, we're being sent messages that this stuff does exist. And we are here, whoever we are. Now, I know that's kind of far-fetched, but, you know, I don't know how else to describe lots of the phenomena that are taking place across our planet, literally.
Well, Pat, as far as that goes, and you mentioned in the beginning that you want to get your health back to where you can get back out in the bush and maybe do some research. What does that mean as far as your tactics going forward, specifically in relation to Bigfoot?
Well, one thing I would say this, and this is to any person out there listening to this cast, if you're going to go out there, go prepared. And that's part of the follow-up project to Elkins Creek that I'm working on, is I'm trying my best to write a book that is going to handle for any person whether they're a middle schooler or they're 65, I don't care. I'm trying to be inclusive in the ability of a person to collect evidence, what they need to have with them, what, you know, strategies, how to interview, those sorts of things, and put this manual into these people's hands so they can get out there and show them how to do it on a shoestring if they, you know, if it's possible, because you see, that's important to me, because the people who are young and really able to do this oftentimes don't have the monetary clout to go out and drop $10,000 on some sort of giant kit of forensic stuff to be able to do this. So I'm trying to show them, or the potential reader, this is how you do it. This is what I would do. This is a cheap way to do it. This is, you know, and also cover the rules of evidence for a person so they understand how to preserve. If they get blood, this is how you preserve blood. This is how you preserve feces. This is how you preserve this, so that a person would be, you know, basically in any situation, they'd have some way to be armed. Now, personally, my strategy, if I were going forward, would be, I think that chasing, there's is too much waste of time unless you've got a flap, a UFO flap, or some sort of instance where you're having, what do you remember the name of the valley out in Colorado where they had all of the UFO activity back in the 90s? I can't think of the name. It's Saint.
With all of Saint. Oh my gosh, this ran the tip of my tongue. They had all the cattle mutilations and everything.
That's right. Well, if you have, anyway, they had all sorts of stuff taking place. Is it San Gabriela? Either way, it doesn't matter. The point is if you've got a location where you have a focused sort of wave of activity going on, it's worth going to investigate. But it's not necessarily worth going to investigate every report that comes down the pike. I think what a person needs to do as an investigator is you need to identify an area which has a history of these sorts of reports, and you need to focus and concentrate in that area when you're investigating. I mean, I'm not saying, you know, let's do a day trip over here because they've had 16 UFO sightings and 3 Bigfoot sightings in last month. Well, that may provide fruit. So you might be worth, you know, your trip to go examine this area. But, you know, a lot of times, you know, I chased one guy down in, you know, it was down in South Alabama. Anyway, you know, I got down there and, you know, he claimed Bigfoot, you know, was wearing, like, you know, women's clothing or whatever. And it just turned out that I wasted 2 hours of time and gasoline, essentially. So you have to kind of become sort of, I don't want to say skeptical, because I don't want to say that people who report this, but I would just say you need to read, if you're reading an encounter through the media, assess it before you invest time and money to go there. Because what I found was that in our area, the things that seemed to be necessary were mountainous, and we have little mountains down here. They're really more or less hills, water sources, food sources. And then I'm talking exclusively about Bigfoot now, but you need a set of, these sorts of parameters for the area to be viable to look at. My strategy, honestly, you know, I have found that going into the woods, now I carry a firearm with me, but this is not for Bigfoot. I want people to understand that we live in crazy times, and if I have a firearm, it's just literally so that I'm not down there and I run across somebody's meth lab or something.
Exactly.
Right. I'm not out, you know, I'm not out to bother any creature or anything. In fact, I used to hunt. I don't even hunt, you know, not against people hunting, but it's just me. It's my sort of idea of the ethics. If I'm not going to eat it, I'm certainly not going to hunt it. So, you know, I'm out there. I don't want to harm Bigfoot. I'd like to study Bigfoot, but you just need to plan. Well, let me go back. You know what? I think that strategy of finding a location, and I also think that you should take, you know, it depends, you know, you might be a female investigator, a male investigator, go down there if you're pretty positive you've got activity, and go camp out, like a family would. If you got kids, especially, for whatever reason, they seem to be attracted to the sound of kids. And be careful, though, because, you know, a lot of stuff, they seem unfortunately very attracted to females and kids. And I believe Brenda Harris out at the Navajo Reservation reported, you know, attempts to kidnap or to seize, you know. So that's a real issue out there with at that location. So, like I said, you got to be on guard. But I think that the activity of a normal camping family, you know, laughing, cook something, let the smell. I think that seems, if there is an attractant, I think that's it. And, you know, otherwise, I think sometimes I really honestly think that it's either stupid good or bad luck that you're going to encounter anything at all out there. I really think that you can go every day for, you know, 20 years and never see anything. Then the one day you go and you don't expect to see anything, that's the day. And that seems to sort of be the Murphy's Law of investigating and hunting Bigfoot. I'd like to get a team together, maybe, but specifically for research into, you know, trying to understand and observe what we're dealing with first before we attempt any kind of real contact or anything like that. You know, this is assuming that they want any contact with us, frankly. You know, we don't know what we're dealing with, at least I don't. And I don't know, you know, I'm kind of at a loss. I want to answer your question, but there's so many factors involved in this that if it were just some sort of actual primate, it would be easy to hunt it, to track it, to find it, because it would have set feeding patterns. It would have, you know, predictable behaviors. But a lot of the stuff that comes out of these creatures is not at all according to the laws of nature that we accept from the animal kingdom. You might have some behaviors. It might eat food. It might exist in a tangible way. But there are also reports of, like you said earlier, things just basically winking out of existence. I remember one place in California, a guy said he saw it and all the hair stood upright on the creature and it stopped the engine of his car. I've heard stories of people shooting the thing in the chest with a 30-30, it get knocked down, stand up, walk away. Well, if you know anything about ballistics, you know, I was a police officer. I've seen basically every kind of gunshot wound imaginable. And I promise you, I don't care if it's a polar bear. If you hit something up close with a high-powered rifle, it's not going to get up and walk away. Now, I don't care how thick you think it may be or how tall or strong. I myself, in my own life, have seen so many wounds and examples of what a high-powered rifle can do that there's no way that this is a biological creature. If it gets up and walks away, it might limp away, but it's going to leave a blood trail. You're going to find this creature. So I don't know. I can't really sum this up for you in a nice package, because I would just say that the biggest strategy I would use, or anybody would use, is this: think outside the box. Okay. I'm not saying disregard all of the past experience that other people have written about. I'm not saying that they're wrong. I'm saying incorporate what these people gleaned from their investigations, and then you think for yourself, think freely about this, and go out and pursue it on your own terms. You know, that's one thing that I guess I'm preaching, and every time I do this, I do think for yourself, because we're going to have to be innovative. You know, the definition of insanity is doing the same action over and over again and expecting a different result. We've got to change the way we investigate these creatures. You know, I'll be honest with you. I had thought before, in a lot of ghost hunters, you know, why don't you employ some of the stuff they use in ghost hunting, like the EMF meters and stuff, when you're out looking for Bigfoot. why don't we do some ultra, the cameras that, that take things in the ultra perspective, spectrum of light. Not just the infra, but go to the next one. Go to the one above it, the ultra. Use innovation and disregard, you know, the haters. I'm going to use it. I know that's popular speech, but they're going to be, every time you try something new, somebody's going to hate on you. Just do it anyway. Don't worry about what they say. If they had anything, they'd have Bigfoot. It'd be in their garage.
That is very true.
So, you know, go out and do something that you want to do. Use your own mind, your own creativity, your own imagination. Don't allow yourself to be censored because you've decided to think outside the box and think differently. Okay. That's the best advice to anybody I have that's in this going forward. And I've already got that sort of mindset myself. So I'm open to all sorts of innovation as far as that goes. I'm just really not out there right now to really put feet on the ground and put it into action.
So this is kind of a two-part for you here, Pat. You mentioned earlier that you, in a, but pretty much a quote, you said, quote, crazy stuff started to happen, assuming in and around your house. So are you going to be including some of your personal experiences in the follow-up book? And do any of those experiences include any Bigfoot activity?
Well, no. You know what? The thing is none of the experiences around the house include any kind of Bigfoot activity. It's just really bizarre sorts of instances of like feeling a presence in the house at times. And my wife can, you know, she could back me up on this. And, you know, I don't know. Maybe they're mutually exclusive, but a friend... Well, I'll synopsize this. There's a friend who had a mirror, and the mirror was supposedly haunted. And curiosity killed the cat. And I said, well, let me see the mirror. I'd like to see if there's anything to it, because I'm just that sort of person. And I brought the mirror in, and nothing initially happened. But then in time, I feel like stuff did start happening, like, you know, we heard like singing, or I did in the living room, and just some really unsettling sorts of things to the point that I have banished the mirror. I've got the mirror currently protected, sealed off in a way so that it's out of our living environment and can't, if it does work off of energy, it's not getting any now. Okay. And all of this stuff started happening during the time that I was finishing up and doing Elkins Creek. And I, you know, is it related? I can't prove that it's related. I'm just saying anecdotally again, and I put that in the book. Hey, this is taking place. But, you know, John Keel said years ago, who wrote Mothman Prophecies, and who really in a lot of ways, I think, was truly a visionary. And that's a good place to start for anybody is, you know, I don't really talk about my own book in the sense that I tout it to be, but I would say if you can get to John Keel, you should read John Keel, find his works. But he said, there's something else out there. He called them cosmic jokers. But, you know, I don't know the definition of what it could be, but I do know this, and this is from my own personal experience, that the deeper you delve into this, the more you're noticed for having noticed them. See, most people, I think, go through life completely oblivious. They, you know, they work their job. They focus on the weekend. They focus on whatever activity they're going to do, whether it's watching television or we're going to the amusement park or we're going to the beach. They, you know, they're living for the weekend, and on the weekend, they basically, they're just going through with blinders on them. They're not really observing. But once you get awakened and you begin to observe, I feel like it sends a message that this person now has noticed this. So let's send them more to get noticed. And I think they really, truly abide you. I don't know your personal life, but I would almost bet. You're out west, but I would almost make a bet that strange things happen around you on a fairly regular basis because of what you're doing and because you are actively exploring this area. And whether you can call it coincidence, whether you call it synchronicity or whatever, if the more you look at this stuff, the more this stuff looks at you. You know, Nietzsche said, if you stare into the abyss long enough, eventually the abyss will stare back into you. Well, perhaps not something so ominous as Nietzsche meant, but certainly in a way, if you focus your intellect on this phenomena, don't be surprised if the phenomena doesn't begin to manifest itself back into your life. It's almost like, oh, well, you believe we exist. Well, okay, I'm going to prove to you that we do exist, whoever they is. I'll give you a quick for instance. Now, I don't have the permission. This person is deceased, but he was a researcher out in Northern California. He shared this story. He said he was up two states away in a very sort of remote mountainous area, had encountered Bigfoot up there, and Bigfoot basically was harassing him, scaring him, terrifying him. And he yelled at him, he said, you know, if I ever get out of here, you're never going to get to blank with me again. He made it out. Next day, he crosses two states. He gets home. He's in a very urban area in northern San Francisco around the bay. And says that evening, he hears a big thump sound out of the trash can. He's wondering, you know, is the neighbor's dog in the trash can? He goes to the window. He looks out. And he says, there's the same Bigfoot creature standing next to the trash can. And he said the creature was staring him directly in his eyes. And he said he was on the second floor of his home. So when he looked out, it was like the creature knew where he was going to look out at, which sent chills up my spine when he told me this. But he said the creature just looked at him and said it faded away. And he said he felt like that this was a message to him that we can do what we want to do. And, you know, you have to take this maybe as a grain of salt. It's not my story. I can't vouch it, but it was told to me. But it made my mind begin to believe that there's more to this than meets the eye.
Boy, talk about a case of PTSD after that, huh?
Oh, my gosh. I wouldn't have slept again.
No, never. You'd never sleep again. How would you?
Never again.
Oh, no. Yeah, I have things that I call my no list, and I'm happy to put that right on there. No, thank you. Well, James P. Aiken has been my guest very fortuitously, might I add, again. Pretty incredible what happened there, I have to say. And his book, Elkins Creek, is on Amazon. Pat, is there anywhere else that you need to plug as far as, like you said, you like to keep a low profile, but...
Did I speak over you?
No, you're fine. I just wanted to be sure that I was covering all the bases. I know you like to keep a low profile, so I just want to keep that however you want to do that as far as where people can find you.
Well, at the time, right now, I do have jpaiken.com, but it's under construction. And, you know, I'm planning hopefully over the next few months to when other things happen in my personal life, I'm just really not right now able to keep it up. So in the future, it'll go active. Until then, you can find Elkins Creek at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any of the major online booksellers. But let me say this. I'm not in this for money. If you buy the book, you have my gratitude, and I appreciate that you took the time to buy my book. But say you're out there and you don't have lots of money, you're a student. If you get it from a library, you go get it. If you can borrow it from your aunt's, you know, second cousin, and you can read the book and glean from it, you go ahead. Like I said, that's one thing I always say is this isn't about money for me. I don't care about that. I care about getting the message out to those people who are interested in it. Yeah, now I will have stuff coming out. Hopefully one's going to be completely unrelated to this area of investigation. And the other will, like I said, more likely be an investigator sort of manual. but it's in the pipeline. And you know what? I'll be frankly honest with you. Things are going to have to settle down nationally for me to get more productive right now. So, like I said, you know, I appreciate anybody who's interested in the book, and I appreciate you for having me on the show today. And thank you. I'm glad that we were able to meet this way, and for however it happened, I'm thankful. And thank you for being such a nice host. I really enjoyed this. Thank you.
Well, good, Pat. So did I. No, absolutely. And by the way, of course, I'm looking forward to our next chat, which hopefully will go down soon. But no, I can't thank you enough for doing this. And it will not be our last talk by far. So thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Well, I'm so-and-so. I was given this name by my parents. I've been to such and such a college. I've done these things in my profession. I produce a little bark. Buddha says, forget it. There's nothing. That's some story. That's all gone. That's all past. I want to see the real you are now. Well, nobody knows who that is. Because we don't know ourselves except through listening to our echoes. Consulting our memories. But then there's a real evil, and that again leads us back to this question. Who are you? That is the meaning. We shall see how they play with this exam. By the koans, to get you to come out of your shell and find out who you really are. settled down in the train to read your newspaper and so on. You are not the same person who a little while ago left the platform. If you think you are linking your moments up in the chain. And this is what binds you to the wheel of birth and death. But when you know that every moment in which you are is the only moment, this comes into Zen. A master will say to somebody, get up and walk across the room. And he comes back and he says, where are your footmen? They've gone. So where are you? Who are you? When we are asked who we are, we usually give a kind of recitation of a history.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Get all the Masterforce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with Masterforce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with Masterforce power equipment at Menards.
Save